Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As increasing numbers of states ignore America's chief public health organization, the CDC, who recommend the daily monitoring of healthcare workers exposed to Ebola instead of isolation, we'll begin with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases, and discuss the case of nurse Casey Hickox, who has no symptoms and has tested negative for Ebola, after being forcibly held in a makeshift isolation ward by New Jersey's Governor Christie. She defied the quarantine on healthcare workers imposed on her in Maine by riding her bicycle surrounded by police officers. We will also discuss different approaches other nations have taken to controlling the outbreak in West Africa, with Cuba setting a positive example, while Australia offers the worst example. Then, on the second anniversary of the devastation of the Northeast by Superstorm Sandy, we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning senior reporter with ProPublica, Jesse Eisinger, who has investigated the role of the American Red Cross, whose response to the disaster is at odds with the hundreds of millions of dollars the American people gave them in donations. We will discuss his new article at ProPublica, The Red Cross's Secret Disaster, and how the charity, under the leadership of a former marketing executive from AT&T, diverted assets away from relief for public relations purposes. Then we'll examine the explosive failure of a space station supply mission with Carl Grossman, the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and look into the consequences of launching nuclear reactors into space, which, had it been the case with Tuesday's abortive launch, a swath of the coast of Virginia would have been turned into a dead zone for 50,000 years. Then we will speak with award-winning filmmaker Margaret Brown about her new documentary feature, The Great Invisible, which explores the lasting legacy of the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf that BP has tried to cover up with a massive PR campaign. Her film tells the human story of how the world's worst environmental disaster impacted the people in the area, the fishermen as well as the oil workers, and how the truth will eventually surface, just like the oil hidden below on the seabed. Joining us now is Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. He was recently arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
Thank you very much.
And of course, I was referring to the demonstrations down in North Carolina on Moral Monday that have been going on some time now. A somewhat different subject, which we can certainly talk about later, but let's talk about the story that's obsessing America and obsessing the media and obsessing our politicians, many of whom are behaving in somewhat ignorant ways. You have the CDC, the America's chief public health organization, recommending the daily monitoring of healthcare workers have been exposed to Ebola instead of isolation, and yet more and more states in this country are imposing quarantines. So what explains this march of folly?
So this is very familiar. As you know, I'm 62, and I've been taking care of patients infected with HIV since the beginning of the epidemic in 1981 in the United States. So this is so familiar to those early days and the mass hysteria that occurred around patients with HIV. I don't know if your listeners will remember that in Florida there was a home with a family, and they had two boys with hemophilia, and the home was firebombed in the early 80s. And in Kokomo, Indiana, Ryan White, who was a young schoolboy with hemophilia and was infected with HIV and had AIDS, he was chased out of the school system by the teachers and principal and superintendent and classmates and neighbors, and the family had to move to a neighboring school district, which took him in. And the Ryan White Act, which is a federal bill that helps fund care for patients with HIV, was in his memory. So this is not new. And in the old days, we had doctors who refused to take care of these patients. Emergency rooms would turn away patients with HIV. So this is the same story. And these are people who, no matter how much information you give them, they still react hysterically and without a basis of science. And of course, I don't want to cast aspersions because you are a media person, but the media certainly does often fan this. Now we have the 24-hour cable news, which we didn't have with the HIV, so that the media is fanning this frenzy. So there is no risk to the general public in the United States, and there's lots of evidence about why that's true. And there are 4 points of what they're in. First of all, the infectiousness of Ebola. So the incubation period for the virus is 2 to 21 days, but it's almost always within 8 to 12 days. And patients are not infectious if they don't have symptoms, such as fever. That's number one. Number two, piece of evidence, Doctors Without Borders, it's also called Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, they've had over 700 workers, doctors and nurses, who've worked for them in these high-risk areas, Ebola treatment units we call them, who've flown home on public commercial transportation and have also flown on domestic transportation, taken trains, public buses, etc. They have family members, etc. No other person has become infected, okay? There are 3 Doctors Without Borders workers who have been infected. They were infected while working overseas, but there have been no secondary cases, even for those Doctors Without Borders cases. So no family members became infected by being near those folks. Point number three is the Liberian patient, Mr. Duncan, the Dallas patient. So remember, he wasn't hospitalized for the first 4 days of his illness. And he exposed several family members in a small apartment, including children, his fiancée, etc., as well as members of the general public. No one else became infected, and he was actively ill. So no member of his family, no member of the general public became infected. And the fourth point is the healthcare staff in the United States working with Ebola patients. There's now been several patients with confirmed Ebola virus hospitalized at the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, in Nebraska, in Dallas at that hospital, and in Emory and in New York City most recently. And literally hundreds of doctors, nurses, and other staff have been exposed to these patients. Yet only 2 people have become infected, and only because they were given inadequate protective gear in one hospital, the Dallas hospital. No other healthcare worker has been infected, and no contacts of any of those workers have been infected. So the general public is not at risk for Ebola. Now, I'm going to keep on going here to my soapbox, so bear with me. So the question is, why? 2 other points that I think we need to address is, why shouldn't we close the borders in the United States? And the reason is because we've got to solve this problem over there. Closing the borders will not keep people out. People can lie and say where they've been, and they can get into the country. And if they lie, then they're not going to go to the healthcare workers and when they're sick, and then the general public will be exposed. So it's better to have transparency and keep it open. And we've got to attack the problem there in West Africa. We can't wait for it to come here. It's very similar to the ISIS situation. So ISIS are those nutty Islamic fighters in Syria and Iraq. And we're not saying, oh, let everyone else deal with it. We're going to just stay put in the United States. It's because we understand after 9/11 that crazy people can get into the United States and kill Americans. And so we have to attack the problem over there. The same thing is true with Ebola. If we don't stop this epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, then it will spread to other countries in Africa and then spread to the United States and Europe, and then it will be a catastrophe and put the general public at risk. So that's why we have to keep the borders open, but screen people as they come in. We have to make sure the commercial flights are going so that healthcare workers can get there and back, and the general public is not at risk. This is just hysteria.
So what do you make of the case of the nurse, Casey Hickox, who has no symptoms and has tested negative for Ebola? She was forcibly held in a makeshift isolation ward by the New Jersey governor, Christie, after she'd arrived at Newark Airport. And she has since defied the quarantine and healthcare workers imposed on her in Maine by riding her bicycle surrounded by police officers.
So, she's actually a hero of mine. So, and this is having a huge impact on recruitment. So most of the people going overseas are volunteers, okay? They're taking their vacation time and doing this. So they are really good Samaritans. They're saints. And for them to treat her like that when there's no risk to them is totally nutty and a waste of money. So the number of people volunteering for two Christian organizations based headquartered in North Carolina, SIM and Samaritan's Purse. I heard this morning the two leaders of that say that the volunteers were down over a third, over 33%. So this is going to have a big impact on slowing down. So she doesn't pose any risk to the general public. It doesn't fly through the air, and no one's going to get this from her. You know, I'm going overseas, and the team I've put together are going overseas. We built in sort of a self-imposed home monitoring quarantine for 3 weeks. But when I come back, I'm going to go for a run. I'm not going to go, shopping or taking public transportation, but I'm going to go running in Liberia and Sierra Leone, and I'm going to run in Chapel Hill when I get back.
So what do you make of the different approaches that nations are taking? Cuba seems to be setting a very positive example by early on sending a lot of healthcare workers and doctors. Conversely, Australia, under a really sort of thuggish prime minister who is pandering shamelessly to the lowest common denominator, he has forbid any Australian healthcare workers from going to and from the affected areas in West Africa. So that seems to be a stark example of the wrong way to approach it.
So the only way, although this disease has many similarities to AIDS, there are some significant differences, namely the speed of its spread, the enormous risk to the healthcare workers who are taking care of these patients, as well as the fact that it's so far, for the most part, solely located in very resource-constrained settings. So they don't have the doctors and nurses, they don't have the labs, they don't have the hospitals to take care of these patients. The roads are terrible, electricity goes out. So this makes it a really huge problem. And because of that, the only way we're going to solve this issue is if all the governments come together and contribute, if all the U.S. and European universities work as a team, as the healthcare workers, the people collaborate, the private foundations and U.S. government and foreign government agencies and the U.N., that we work together as a team and don't operate by the usual paradigm. If we do business as usual, then this is going to be a disaster. All right. So I, for instance, my group, I could have made it the UNC Ebola Clinical Research Consortium. But I decided that was dumb, and I didn't want to compete with other universities. So we're making it the Ebola Clinical Research Consortium, and they're going to be faculty and nurses and physicians assistants from Duke, from UNC, from UCSD, and other universities, as we identify them, to work as a team. Because that's what it requires. We have to work as a team, the government. So the fact that Australia is behaving this way, or the governor of Illinois or New Jersey, is just stupid. Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Charles van der Horst, when are you leaving? And I certainly want to do an interview with you when you come back.
Sure. Well, I'm going to have a lot of time because I'm going to be in quarantine. Hopefully not in a tent in Newark. I am leaving right now. My visa comes through November 10th.
I see. Well, I wish you all the best, and I can commend you and all other healthcare workers who are doing the Lord's work in spite of stupid and ignorant stigmatization of the very people who are doing the work that needs to be done where the outbreak is, because if it's not contained there, then it really will become a problem. So
right.
I thank you again.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Charles van der Horst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. He was recently arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Red Cross did not behave well after the devastating Superstorm Sandy hit 2 years ago.
Anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jesse Eisinger, who is a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. And in 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. He is the co-author of a new article at ProPublica, The Red Cross's Secret Disaster. Welcome to Background Briefing. Jesse
Hi,
Eisinger.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, this story that you've broken here, it sort of feels like, you know, is there anything left that's sacred? I mean...
Well, it's certainly the case that the people we spoke to want the Red Cross to be better, that they really talk to us, I think, more in sorrow than in anger. They dedicated portions of their lives to the Red Cross and have been disappointed in the direction that the organization has taken.
And, of course, we're talking about how the Sandy storm 2 years ago, and we're speaking on the anniversary, of course, devastated New Jersey and New York and all the Northeast with floods. And I guess the bottom line in here seems to indicate, just from what you've told us about the rank and file that you spoke to, is that there's a leadership problem at the top. But the context has to be how many hundreds of millions of dollars poured into the Red Cross from concerned Americans who were watching the devastation of Sandy on their televisions.
Yes, Americans donated more than $300 million for Sandy to the Red Cross. And, of course, they went out and they claimed that they were giving people food and shelter and blankets and flashlights and supplies to deal with the devastation of Sandy. And what we found is that they often were not around. They didn't show up. They didn't scale up their relief efforts properly, so it took them a long time. And instead, perhaps most damningly, they often put public relations over people. They diverted assets to press conferences for photo ops and these things. And it's not just that we talk to people. These are actually from their own internal documents of their top executives from headquarters talking about many of these problems and issues.
And, of course, President Obama is the charity's honorary chairman, and he vouched for the group after Superstorm Sandy, telling Americans to donate. The Red Cross knows what you're doing, he said.
Yes, said, you know, the Red Cross knows what it's doing.
Sorry,
yeah, the Red Cross isn't the NSA, at least not yet. But the... Obama said that, and as you said, he serves in the ceremonial role. It's a storied organization. It's been around since 1881. It's actually congressionally chartered, and while the government doesn't actually give it any money, it does have an official role alongside FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, in performing disaster relief. So we count on the Red Cross as Americans to help us in our time of need. And that's why it's such a vital institution for the United States. And this is why we, the people that we spoke to and the internal documents confirm this, were so concerned with the shortfalls in Sandy and the earlier storm Isaac.
So what's the relationship between the Swiss parent company, or if that indeed company is the right word, of Red Cross? What's the relationship with the U.S. branch?
They're not related to each other. They're affiliated, and in international responses, there's the International Red Cross, which is the organization based in Switzerland, then there's the American Red Cross, and they're separate organizations, although they do work together in international disasters frequently, and then sometimes the American Red Cross comes in to help in things like Haiti. So the American Red Cross has some international work, but most of it is done domestically.
So what do we know in terms of what happened to the 300 million or so that the American public ponied up after Superstorm Sandy to the Red Cross?
Well, we know that what the Red Cross says it did with the money is not very clear. It's not particularly opaque. They said they gave out 17 million meals and snacks, that they gave shelter stays, 74,000 of those, that they handed out 7 million bulk items like flashlights, blankets, things like that. But they don't really explain how much that cost them. They don't explain exactly how they gave the money out to other organizations. Sometimes they funnel money to other organizations, and there's unclear disclosures about that. And then what we found in this story is that a lot was going to waste. They were very concerned about the numbers. In one case, they were trying to get the numbers of meals up. And so despite what people were saying on the ground about the lack of feasibility of a plan, the headquarters said you got to increase the meals overnight by 200,000 meals to a caterer that was only doing 20,000 meals, and they defaulted on that contract, and they had to throw out hundreds of millions of dollars of meals. So a lot of that money that Americans gave, that $300 million, clearly was wasted.
But what's so extraordinary about your story that you've uncovered here, Jesse Eisinger, is the extent to which the Red Cross seemed like, for many people, the safest place you could put your charitable donations. That's their sort of reputation. And clearly that had, it led to people really opening up their checkbooks in the case of Lady Gaga and T. Boone Pickens and I'm looking for the reference. Who's the other actor?
Well, we referred to Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage.
Bruce Springsteen urged people to give to the Red Cross. Not only did President Obama, but Mitt Romney as well. This is the marquee donation destination for celebrities, for wealthy people. Michael Dell gives, and also for corporations. In fact, it's hard to find a major corporation in the United States that doesn't give substantial amounts to the Red Cross. But as we found, what they were doing with the money was sometimes assigning it to PR. One of the internal reports that we found and we put on the web at ProPublica.org in our story is it says they were diverting assets for public relations purposes. And in fact, we found examples of that. We found an order from headquarters to move emergency response vehicles, as many as you can, to Staten Island for a press conference. That was diverting things away away from need. They needed those emergency response vehicles to deliver supplies to people who were sitting hungry in the dark in flooded homes, who are not getting help, and could have used the Red Cross's help. Of course, there were other organizations. There was the federal government, state and local officials, but the Red Cross could have also helped. But instead, what they were doing was diverting assets to public relations. We found an event where they hosted the supermodel Heidi Klum, a sort of photo op. She gave out a few items to families, but she was doing it in such a way that it actually tied up multiple people, multiple volunteers and officials from the Red Cross and vehicles for hours in an area that they weren't actually conducting much actual relief efforts. So that was the kind of thing that they were very focused on, public relations over people in need.
And in the case of the Staten Island photo op, these trucks, these Red Cross trucks, were empty, and they were instructed to sort of drive around in circles to make it look like they were doing something.
Well, that actually was a separate incident in Mississippi for the storm that hit a little bit before Sandy. If you recall, in 2012, Hurricane Isaac hit about 6 weeks before Sandy, 2 months before Sandy, in late August, and right around the Republican National Convention. And that was really a debacle for the Red Cross. They were struggling to get the proper amounts of resources and supplies on the ground to the victims. And in one case near Hattiesburg, two people told us, and these people were on the record in our story, that they were told to drive around in empty trucks, 80 empty emergency response vehicles and trucks, just to look like you were doing something, just to be seen, a real kind of Potemkin relief effort.
So when Lady Gaga and Nicolas Cage and the oil man T. Boone Pickens gave $1 million each, how much is the discretion with the people at the top about what they do with this money? I mean, I recall that Elizabeth Dole, the wife of former Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole, was the head of the American Red Cross. Is this a political position? Is this a sinecure of some kind? Or do they put people in charge who really know what they're doing and are professional humanitarian workers?
Well, the Red Cross has gone through a number of rocky periods and scandals. After 9/11, the volunteers were wandering around giving away checks to very wealthy people in the wealthy neighborhood of Tribeca, which they came in for a lot of criticism for. In Katrina, there were a lot, Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, there were a lot of financial mismanagement allegations and scandals and problems there. There was a serial sort of problem with the Red Cross, and they were going through many CEOs. And then in 2008, they hired Gail McGovern, who is an executive from AT&T, and she was viewed as a stabilizing presence, and she's been there since then, 6 years or so. And so people really thought that she was doing a better job, but as we found, there are really questions about their preparedness for disaster relief, whether they are actually spending the money properly and efficiently. And this is an organization that's going through huge reorganizations. They've been closing chapters. They're laying people off. They're struggling with budget deficits. And so it's an organization that certainly hasn't stabilized as much as the public perception of it would have suggested.
But it must be a 501c3, a tax-exempt charity. Wouldn't all of their records be available? Don't they have to publish their accounts?
Yes, they do. They publish their tax filings. It's called the 990. They publish their annual reports. So you can see their numbers. You can see what they're generating in revenue. In fact, most of the revenue comes from their famous blood donation business, but they generated about $1 billion in donations last year. That in their last year, that makes them one of the biggest charities in the United States. But when you start to get to really the kind of numbers of how much they're spending on Sandy, that's when the opacity really kicks in and you can't actually tell that much from the numbers.
But can you determine how much money they're spending on head office and executives and how much money they're spending on the ground?
It's a very good question. They claim that on average, 91 cents of every dollar they spend goes to disaster relief. But as you say, there's a lot of discretion in that number, and it's worth sort of examining that to figure that out.
So who is, if there's a corporate executive running the Red Cross, does she think in terms of it as a corporation? In other words, all corporations have public relations. If an oil company makes an oil spill, they immediately put out commercials telling you how much they care about the environment. I mean, we know, you know, without being too cynical, their job is to, in many ways, to greenwash or whitewash what they're doing. So what's the sense of Heidi Klum and all of this stuff? Is that an example of this kind of attempt to put a kind face on, you know, a less than attractive operation?
Well, I think that they need some public relations and public affairs to get out the word that you can donate to them so that they can give disaster relief to people. And certainly they do give some disaster relief. It's not like they don't do anything at all. Of course they do. But the question is of emphasis and waste. A lot of their resources do appear to have gone clearly to public relations. And Gail McGovern, who came in, she was this former AT&T executive, this former corporate executive. She was also a marketing professor at Harvard Business School. So marketing is in her blood. And in an early interview, she said that the Red Cross was a brand to die for. You know, most people probably wouldn't think of the Red Cross as a brand that needs to be kind of expanded like so much McDonald's hamburgers, but that it's a precious philanthropic organization. But, you know, corporate speak has kind of overtaken a lot of American culture and has sort of seeped into the nonprofit arena as well. And so that kind of language is, unfortunately, in my view, fairly common.
Well, the reason that Lady Gaga and Nicolas Cage and T-Boone Pickens and Bruce Springsteen and all of these celebrities wrote $1 million checks was because it is such a great brand, and the expectation is that your money is being well spent. So that's what's so shocking about the story that you've done.
I agree. I mean, you know, I think that people hold the Red Cross accountable and expect a lot from it, which we think is a valid thing to do. I think, you know, when people give their hard-earned money to donate to a philanthropic organization, they expect it to be well spent.
Well, just in closing, have you heard anything back from Gail McGovern?
No, not from her. She declined to talk to us, but we talked extensively to the Red Cross before our story ran. You know, we run everything by them. We're very careful reporters, very thorough. We sent them many, many questions, and they responded. Unfortunately, they responded in ways that often were misleading, highly misleading, and obfuscatory. But we incorporated many of their responses into the story, and we welcome you know, any continuing dialogue with them or with former and current Red Cross employees who can reach us through our website, ProPublica.org, and to talk about the organization and their financial management.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jesse Eisinger.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jesse Eisinger, who's a senior reporter at ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times' Deal Book section, and in 2011, he and Jake Bernstein were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped make the financial crisis the worst since the Great Depression. He's the co-author of a new article at ProPublica, The Red Cross's Secret Disaster.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the explosive failure of a space station supply mission and what would happen if there was a nuclear reactor on board. ¶¶ Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Carl Grossman, a veteran investigative reporter and professor of journalism at the State University of New York College of Old Westbury. He is the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and for the last 30 years has been challenging the use of nuclear power in space. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Grossman.
A pleasure to be with you, Ian.
And I take it that if this Antares rocket built by the NASA contractor Orbital Sciences Corporation that exploded on the launching pad at NASA's Wallops flight facility on the Virginia coast, had it been carrying any nuclear cargo, it would have been a catastrophe. Apparently, it's a bit of a catastrophe to begin with, because even the solid propellant in these rockets is incredibly toxic. But I take it that the area around where this rocket exploded would have been like, what, Chernobyl or something?
Well, it's extremely, it's folly, as I consider it, to have nuclear material aboard rockets. I mean, the failure rate on launch of rockets is 1 in 100. So right off, you're not talking about perfection here. You're talking about an always 1% chance of failure on launch. And if you, in that equation, insert nuclear material, the fuel, as you say, is quite toxic, the chemical fuel. But radioactive material, particularly plutonium, and that's what the United States has emphasized in its space nuclear power systems, plutonium. You're talking about the most radioactive substance, plutonium, in a launch accident or other sorts of accidents in which material on board a rocket could be released. You're talking about an enormous disaster.
Well, already, Frank Culbertson, a former NASA astronaut who is now manager of Orbital Sciences Corporation, who built the rocket that exploded, he's putting out a directive, quoting, "If you find anything that washes ashore in the local area or came down on your farm or in your yard, definitely do not touch it and keep people away from it." So what is it that's so bad about the debris? And this is, presumably, it's not contaminated by nuclear material.
Well, they're very concerned about the toxic impacts of the fuel, the chemical fuel. But, you know, I've been on this story, as you say, for 30 years. And frankly, I don't trust, well, NASA nor the private contractors of NASA. For me, it's been, I got into this issue back in 1985 when I learned about two space shuttles that were to be launched in 1986 carrying plutonium-fueled space probes. One of the shuttles was a shuttle called the Challenger. In fact, a nuclear mission was to be the next mission in 1986 of the ill-fated Challenger. I read about these two shots, these two launches, in a Department of Energy newsletter, and I filed right away a Freedom of Information Act request with NASA, the Department of Energy, and the national nuclear laboratories involved in these two projects, according to the article that I read in this Department of Energy newsletter. It took almost a year to get any information, and finally, when I did get information in response to my questions, what would be the impacts of a launch pad accident, a fall of the shuttle from altitude, in which the plutonium would be released, a fall of the shuttle from orbit, in which the plutonium would be released, and also, what are the alternatives to these missions in regards to using nuclear power? It took over a year, and it took a major fight on my part to get any information. Bottom line, and again, this begins my distrust of NASA and its contractors. The bottom line was NASA claiming that the likelihood of a catastrophic shuttle accident was highly unlikely. I mean, infinitesimally unlikely. In fact, NASA provided a numbers, 1 in 100,000, as the chance of a catastrophic accident. And, I sat with this information for a while, and then in January of 1986, the Challenger blew up shortly after launch. NASA, incidentally, quickly changed the odds of a catastrophic shuttle accident from 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 76, quite a change. And those were realistic odds, it turns out, because out of 150 shuttle launches, two met with disaster. And in any case, I stayed on the story year after year following that entry into the issue of nuclear power in space. And just let me add, I kept wondering why use plutonium-powered electric generating systems was what would be used on these two space probes that would be carried up on the shuttles. Why use these plutonium systems? For example, the NASA mission involving the Challenger, in which it was to loft a plutonium fuel space probe, was called Ulysses, and that was to involve orbits of the sun. I mean, you can't use solar photovoltaic panels on an orbit of the sun. In any case, as the months and as the years went by, it came down to, three basic issues. One, the national nuclear laboratories like Los Alamos, run by the University of California, let me note, and Oak Ridge and Argonne involved in space nuclear power planning and production. They wanted the grants. They wanted the money. Then you got to always, as the words went in the Watergate investigation, follow the money. Who made these plutonium systems? The contractor for the government was a company called General Electric. Now the plutonium systems that NASA has and seeks to use are made by Lockheed Martin. And third, there was a military connection. The Star Wars program, and again, I got into this issue in the 1980s, Reagan's Star Wars program was predicated on nuclear-powered battle platforms. Nuclear power would provide the energy for the hypervelocity guns, the particle beams, the laser weapons. Indeed, in the book that I finally wrote about all this called The Wrong Stuff, I quote a general head of what was at that point called the Strategic Defense Initiative as saying, without nuclear power in space, we need a long extension cord back down to Earth. So, from what I learned way back then to today, I have been dealing with a program, despite NASA claiming it's a civilian agency, which a space program which is highly militarized, dealing with a program in which corporate profit is it's primary, and a program in which the bureaucracies, these nuclear establishments at these national nuclear laboratories, are deeply involved. And just let me add one last thing. In recent years, it turns out, you don't need nuclear power in space. Well, certainly, I don't know for Star Wars, if you want Star Wars, but for exploration of space. The European Space Agency, a number of years ago, sent up the Rosetta space probe, powered its electric generating system, powered by solar power. And it, just a couple of months ago, rendezvoused with a comet at a distance from Earth, essentially as far out as Jupiter from the sun. NASA's own Juno spacecraft, its electric power being obtained, again with solar, is on its way now to Jupiter. So nukes in space, dangerous, have a military connection, and quite not necessary, certainly in terms of space exploration.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Grossman, who's a veteran investigative reporter and professor of journalism at the State University of New York College of Old Westbury. He is the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. And for the last nearly 30 years, he has been challenging the use of nuclear power in space. So in terms of this rocket that exploded in Virginia, and it was carrying 5,000 pounds of supplies to the International Space Station. Apparently they do have some reserve supplies, and I believe a Russian rocket is going to bridge the gap, if you will. I'm curious about this contractor whose rocket exploded, given that there's also SpaceX, which is the Elon Musk company that also produces the Tesla electric car. My understanding is that even Musk himself has had some sort of quiet criticism of Orbital Sciences, needless to say, a competitor of his, of their technology. What do you know about the deficiencies of Orbital Sciences technology, and therefore, why did they get a contract?
Well, I don't know what Musk's problem with Orbital Sciences. I mean, that it's competition, so I'm sure he's going to criticize. But let me say, even though I love Tesla cars, Musk is very interested in the development of, now we're talking about the future, not the past, of nuclear-powered space systems. Musk is no space greenie. And again, we're talking about competition, and I'd be very, very measured in terms of Musk's criticism of his competition.
Well, Carl Grossman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
A pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Grossman, who's a veteran investigative reporter and professor of journalism at the State University of New York College of Old Westbury. He is the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and for the last nearly 30 years, he has been challenging the use of nuclear power in space. And joining us now is Margaret Brown, a documentary film director and producer who has received many awards, among them the 2010 Peabody Award for her second documentary feature, The Order of Myths. Her latest film just out is The Great Invisible. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margaret Brown.
Thank you.
And your film comes out, as it happens, coincidentally with a new study from scientists at the University of California, Santa Barbara,
right,
who have studied the seabed around where the BP disaster happened in the Gulf of Mexico, and the entire area around it, about the size of Yosemite National Park, apparently has a layer of oil which will never be gotten up. My understanding is it can't be vacuumed up.
Yeah, it's over coral reefs, right, I believe.
Yes, it's basically destroyed all the
right.
It's a mile down. And extraordinarily, though, BP are saying that they don't say that that's necessarily their oil when it's right next to where the blowout happened.
I mean, it is strange because I believe there's a, I think it's called, there's a chemical that's in the oil that I believe they can trace it exactly back to the Deepwater Horizon that was present, so I don't know why they're saying that. I mean, I think they're just going to try to deny anything that connects them until it's just overwhelmingly proven the other way. Yet this does seem overwhelmingly the other way, so I don't understand.
Well, what I think is so welcoming about your film and so necessary is that here we are. I just did a forum at UCLA on global warming, had two of the leading scientists in the world, they're climatologists, and they're basically, the disconnect is the reality of science and the lack of progress, and mm-hmm. and this vestige of denial that's being funded by oil companies.
Right. And this is the greatest challenge that the planet faces. And I see an analogy with the destruction of the Gulf from the BP spill and the broader destruction of our planet, because it seems as though the reason there's a disconnect between the science of global warming and the incredible urgency to do something about it is that the oil companies are making so much money that they can buy off our politicians and delay and delay and delay. Is that what's happening?
I mean, I think that's one of the things that's happening. I think it's also, it's we live in a culture of convenience, and I don't think people think when they fill up their car about like where the oil comes from or how much risk it takes to produce it. So I think it's kind of that. I think that adds to it too. Like, people don't understand it. I think the oil industry has a vested interest in preventing people from thinking about it. I mean, when you go to the gas station, you know, it's meant to look like an ATM booth, which people, there have been studies saying that people feel happy when they go take money out of the ATM machines. They've made oil, like, filling stations look like that, you know. So there's a lot done to distract you from really thinking about your connection, like what you're putting in your car.
And, of course, we are at a time now where oil prices are down and gas is now, in some parts of the country, $3 a gallon, and this has immediately affected the sale of electric cars and hybrids. They've gone down, while the sale of SUVs and pickup trucks has gone up.
Right.
So there's the proof of the addiction that you talk about. In, you know, if you can disguise the, make gas stations seem like ATM, and people are that addicted to oil that they'll change their habits so radically. What's your sense of, I mean, clearly your film is trying to alert us to a greater responsibility here to get off the addiction.
Well, yeah, I mean, I also I'm from the area, and I wanted to make also a portrait of the South, like right now. I didn't want to make a film that, I mean, I think that I wanted my film to make people think about our connection 100%, but I think a lot of films that try to do that from one side, you know, those aren't exactly films that I like to watch personally, so I tried to do something that was a little bit more complicated and shown from different sides, you know, because there's people from the industry in the film, and it also shows some of the people who are on the rig. And but I do. I mean, the film definitely making it, it changed what I thought about, you know, when I fill up my car. I started making the film, it was a portrait of just where I grew up in Alabama and how that was impacted when the cameras, because when the spill started, there were so many cameras down on the Gulf Coast. It was incredible. Just on the beach, the first day we were filming, there were a lot of other cameras, and I was kind of curious what would happen when we got out of the news cycle, you know, when it wasn't, when the plume of oil wasn't on the news every night.
Well, you know, the poster says the truth will surface, and
right.
This, I guess, is what we're talking about here, and it's taken a while, and BP have spent a fortune. I mean, I imagine they spent, what, probably a million times your budget on PR, and they've been pretty successful, haven't they?
I think so. I mean, you know, well, I would say yes and no, because in the South, when those ads run, people are just like, they laugh, you know. I think when we were making the film and we'd be shooting in other parts of the country, when it's not present, you know, people wonder, is it true or not? But I mean, I think people are smart and they sort of see through some of the propaganda those ads are putting out. I think it's a mix, you know. I mean, but yeah, and on the Gulf, people hate those ads.
It would seem that there is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that we're sort of running out of time in terms of where the planet is, and that we sort of have to probably engender some form of global patriotism and get beyond the fact that our parochial national interests, and here we are, as I said, the gas is getting cheaper, the fracking is bringing on oil, everybody's celebrating the fact that we're getting independent, and yet this is the largest man-made environmental disaster in history. And how can people forget it? I mean, how can it be brushed under the table, or in this case, under the ocean?
I think because it's so tied to how we live our lives. I mean, I agree with you. There needs to be some kind of, like, beyond national call because, I mean, that's what I hope my film would be part of that conversation. You know, I don't think, you know, there's so many things we can do, but I think it takes working together. I mean, I was pretty energized by the climate march, but I think it takes more than that. It takes people understanding our connection to the risk that, you know, the possibility, especially now that nothing has changed since the Deepwater Horizon, there haven't been any protections put in place by our government that make things safer out there, make it less likely for a spill to happen. So I think, you know, given that, this can happen quickly again, and I think that people, you know, need to, my film is structured in such a way to, like, bring understanding so we see how we are connected to it, how our culture and how we live our lives is a big part in producing it. It's not just the oil industry, it's us. We're asking them for it. So it's not so black and white as them and us. It's us and us, you know.
What I find powerful about your new film, Margaret Brown, is how much it's about people and the people who are affected by it and even the people who in many ways were responsible for it, at least the people inside the industry. But you don't really bamboozle us with facts and figures. That's what I think is its strength. Is that your idea, that you want to connect with people emotionally as well as factually?
Well, when I was making the film, you know, structuring it, the first pass was I just wanted it to be, I mean, almost no talking heads, just verite, just observing how people are, and trying to kind of have as little almost facts as possible. I know that sounds counterintuitive for a film that's about the oil spill and people want to know facts, but...
Well, that's not to say that it's not factual, though.
No, I mean, everything, all the cards in the movie, everything has been, like, carefully vetted, but, you know, I was trying to kind of give the film an emotional structure rather than, like, than something that was like a chronological fact-based structure, I guess, which I think some people want. You know, they want that kind of, they expect that from documentaries. But I think it's a tricky gray world, this world of, like, petroleum that we're all enmeshed in. And I really was invested in showing that mesh and web of complication and how it affects all these people, from the people who were on the rig that day when it exploded, some of who died and some of whom didn't, to, you know, the oystermen who were impacted, to the people in the oil industry who talk about it. And I wanted people to feel like they were in the room with all those people and feel it from their perspective and kind of see what they think about this whole web and hopefully through that feel their own connection to it.
And your film opens in Los Angeles, New York, where else?
It's opening, it's kind of spreading. I mean, this is opening weekend coming up in New York and L.A. and Santa Barbara, so we'll see how it does there, and that'll dictate. But right now it's opening in a lot of the major markets, and a lot in the South, too. We're opening a lot in the South, in the Southern region. So you can go to thegreatinvisible.com, and you can see where it's opening across the country.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Margaret Brown.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Margaret Brown, who's a documentary film director and producer who has received many awards, among them the 2010 Peabody Award for her second documentary feature, The Order of Myths. Her latest film just out is The Great Invisible. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.